Happy 4th of July. It's an evening update, which usually means the news cycle has slowed down to a crawl. I wanted to check in because we're seeing some shifts in how people are opting out of broken systems, from the way we handle data to how we're rethinking our careers. Enterprise leaders are shifting away from centralized, frontier AI models. Companies are moving toward a model of intelligence sovereignty, where they keep data and compute on private, local hardware. Firms are doing this because they've realized that using third-party models risks commoditizing their own intellectual property. When you feed your proprietary know-how into someone else's platform, you're basically handing the keys to a potential competitor. By switching to a distributed, spoke model, using open-source weights on private hardware, companies are protecting their alpha. It's a strategy that, according to some industry analysis, can be significantly cheaper than relying on the big cloud frontier labs. There's a tension here between the tech sector's internal optimism and the broader economic reality. Labor studies covering 21,000 U.S. firms show that companies adopting AI are growing their headcount faster than those that don't. We aren't seeing mass job displacement yet. Instead, we're seeing a shift where AI acts as a clunky, human-dependent tool that forces a premium on human interaction and oversight. Investors like Mamoun Hamid are framing AI as the commoditization of labor itself, moving from passive tools to active agentic labor that replaces specialized roles. This is forcing venture firms to rethink how they do business. They're moving back to in-person meetings, having realized that remote, Zoom-based diligence is a failure mode. You just can't gauge founder ambition through a screen. Meanwhile, on Wall Street, the second quarter of 2026 saw strong performance, but it's lopsided. The growth is almost exclusively driven by AI infrastructure spending. Here's the thing: we might be approaching a ceiling. Meta is already offloading its excess compute to third parties, which suggests their internal projects aren't quite hitting the mark. If supply starts to outpace demand, those massive profit margins for chipmakers are going to crater. We're sitting on a disconnect. Stock prices are climbing on the assumption of future AI dominance, but 42% of Americans have zero exposure to the market. If interest rates stay high or compute demand levels off, we're looking at a sharp, painful correction. All that speculative spending on infrastructure has to turn into actual, utility-based revenue eventually. If it doesn't, the hype cycle is going to hit a wall. Centralization is becoming a liability. Whether it's a monopolistic AI provider, an over-leveraged state budget, or a broken social contract, the old ways aren't holding. Sovereignty, fiscal, data, or operational, is looking less like a luxury and more like the only strategy for survival. The Saratoga Racing Meet, global soccer shootouts, and tournament-style fantasy sports all share the same fundamental problem: how to win when the environment is constantly trying to trip you up. In horse racing, the challenge is managing volatility. Trainers are currently facing a choice between restricted regional stakes, where they might dominate, or open races where the purses are bigger but the competition is deeper. If you're a bettor, the value isn't in the best horse on paper. It's in spotting when the public is overestimating a horse's lack of local turf experience, or when a sudden shift from firm to yielding track conditions renders historical speed figures totally useless. It's not about predicting the future. It's about betting on which horses have the pedigree to handle the chaos when the ground turns to mud. Meanwhile, in professional soccer, the penalty kick has evolved into a higher-order strategy. It started with economists like Ignacio Palacio Huerta quantifying tendencies: who kicks left, who dives right. But now the game is about knowing that your opponent knows your tendencies. That's why you see players consciously overriding their natural instincts to remain unpredictable. The 2008 Champions League final is often cited as a moment where this data-driven approach became a trap. Chelsea used data to study Manchester United's penalty takers, but the strategy became so patterned that it didn't guarantee a win, and Chelsea ultimately lost the shootout. The common thread here is that data isn't a silver bullet, it's an arms race. In both horse racing and sports betting, the barrier to entry for good analysis has been raised. If you're playing a pick five at Monmouth or Colonial Downs, You don't win by blindly backing the favorite. You win by identifying the vulnerable favorite, the horse that lacks the speed or the pace set up to win. The smart move isn't to be a purist, it's to hedge. You go deep in the legs, where the race is a coin flip, and you save your big bets for the spots where you have a genuine structural edge. It's a portfolio approach. You're trying to balance the risk of a race day collapse against the potential for a massive payout. Then you look at World Cup fantasy, where the strategy shifts entirely once you hit the knockout rounds. You move from accumulating points to survival-based management. This means dumping players from teams that have been eliminated and prioritizing defensive assets who are likely to keep clean sheets in high-stakes matches. The pros aren't wasting their chips early. They're holding on to them for the quarterfinals, where the variables become slightly more predictable. Here's the thing that strikes me about all of this. We love to talk about data-driven decision-making like it's a clean, clinical process. It's not. It's messy. In every one of these systems, the moment an optimal strategy becomes common knowledge, it stops being optimal. Everyone has the same data reports now. The edge no longer comes from having the information. It comes from knowing how to use that information to exploit the blind spots of everyone else. The Federal Reserve is holding steady on interest rates as the labor market cools. Figures cited in some recent market reports suggest June job gains were roughly 57,000, well below the expected 115,000. While Jerome Powell remains Fed chair, the institution has signaled a shift toward prioritizing price stability over maximum employment, while intentionally obscuring dissenting votes to keep the central bank strategy opaque. It's a classic case of the House trying to regain control by keeping the cards close to its chest. By ditching forward guidance, the Fed is essentially telling investors to stop reading the tea leaves and just watch the data. It's a messy way to run an economy, but it gives them the room to pivot without the market throwing a tantrum every time a statement drops. Meanwhile, in New York City, the policy of freezing rents on stabilized units is hitting a wall. The 2019 Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act, designed to keep people in their homes, has effectively turned into a supply killer. Owners are staring down rising costs for insurance and water, and because they can't hike rents to cover the $50,000 to $100,000 needed for unit renovations, many are just opting to leave apartments empty. Industry data suggests vacancies in rent-stabilized units have seen a significant uptick over the last year. It's a shitty situation for everyone involved. You've got a policy meant to solve affordability that's actively removing housing from the market. When you treat the symptom instead of the supply shortage, you just end up with more decay and a system that rewards luck over actual need. This decay isn't unique to housing. Look at Prim, Nevada. Once a high-traffic gambling stop for Californians, the town is dying because regional casinos popped up in other states, stripping away its only competitive advantage, convenience. Las Vegas survived by pivoting to high-end, irreplaceable experiences like the Sphere, but smaller towns like Prim are stuck in a coordination trap. They lack the capital to pivot, so they're just rotting into a logistical stopover. It's a brutal reminder that in a saturated market, if your only value is being on the way, you're already obsolete. We're seeing this same shift in the professional world too. There's a growing movement arguing that certifications and academic credentials are just security blankets for people who don't actually know how to solve a problem. The argument is simple. The market doesn't care about your diploma. It cares about whether you can fix a painful, expensive issue for a client. Those who spend their time chasing credentials instead of gathering case studies are missing the window to build actual authority. It's a rejection of the idea that a board or an institution needs to grant you permission to be competent. That skepticism is bleeding into everything. You've got a segment of the population that's completely checked out, viewing mainstream political and institutional narratives as nothing more than a scripted circus. They see the rise of AI-integrated tech, from smart vehicles to digital price tags, not as progress, but as a framework for a 15-minute city designed to monitor and restrict behavior. Honestly, it's not hard to see why trust is evaporating. When you look at the housing market, regional decay, and the way professional credentials have become gatekeeping tools rather than markers of skill, the system looks less like a functioning machine and more like a series of failing monopolies. The people currently opting out aren't just looking for a new brand of politics, they're looking for a way to survive outside of the bubble. Whether it's by building a track record that bypasses the need for a degree, or by trying to find a corner of the world that isn't dependent on a dying business model, the common thread is clear. People are tired of waiting for institutions to fix the problems they helped create. They're deciding that if the institution can't deliver, they'll stop paying the ticket to the show. That's a massive shift in how we define power, and frankly, it's about time. Before we wrap up, a few other things worth knowing today. Paranormal researchers are finding that high-traffic haunted sites are basically suffering from a collective hallucination. Constant foot traffic and the projection of negative emotions from tourists are essentially creating chimera energies that push out the actual historical entities, meaning the ghosts you're paying to see are just manufactured vibes, which honestly sounds like the most predictable outcome for the tourism industry. If you're still clinging to that old 486 motherboard in your closet, keep it. Engineers are finding that messing with legacy hardware teaches you more about system design than any modern emulator ever could, because you're forced to contend with physical limitations that software just smooths over. It's a good reminder that sometimes the clunky way of doing things is actually the only way to learn how they work. On a personal note for the podcasting world, the host of How to Take Over the World announced he's dealing with a neuroendocrine cancer diagnosis. He's shifting to simpler, single biography episodes to manage his chemo schedule, which is a shitty situation, but a smart way to keep the work going without burning out. Over in the kitchen, there's a case being made that baking is essentially just a stress management tool disguised as dinner. The argument is that mastering a recipe teaches you how to handle failure and build resilience in a way that creates some actual order when the rest of the world feels like a dumpster fire. And finally, the NPR Politics podcast has a tradition of reciting the big speech from the movie Independence Day every year instead of the Declaration of Independence. They claim it's to focus on human unity, which is a hell of a way to handle a political broadcast. I don't know if it's profound or just peak NPR, but it's certainly consistent. That's all for tonight. Stay skeptical, and I'll see you tomorrow.